By the congregation, brothers and sisters in Christ, children of God, friends of Jesus, grace be unto you, and greetings from the Pinal Church in Holmes County. Come and visit us. Well, I feel kind of like an intruder, but I was asked to do this. I was asked to talk about the book, Unsalaid, The Story of the Amish. Normally, it takes me an hour and three-quarter, and I have an overhead projector and all the equipment. I don't have that with me today. It was a surprise. So we'll just improvise a little bit. Okay, let me introduce the book I'm going to talk about. It's a two-volume set. And it's called Unsalaid, The Story of the Amish. And it's a history of the Amish, but I don't call it a history because history books can, as you well know, can get pretty dry and pretty boring. And I tried to do it in story form. The stories of the people. It's not only the history of the Amish, it's the history of the people who lived that faith. One person said, yeah, I like the book, but you got too many names in there. Well, the names are our ancestors, our forefathers, and they were the ones that kept the faith, and that's why we're holding the faith today. Before I get into the book, I'd like to point out three things that are not in the book that I think I want you to remember. If you forget all about the book, remember these three things. First of all, we have, of course, a Bible written 2,000 years ago, nearly. And we know those people, that's where the Christian church started, and we're Christians today. So we assume probably that, like I once did, that we've always been Christians. If we could trace our ancestry back to the time of Christ, we'd assume, well, we've always been Christians. Not quite. We can trace our history back. I think some of our families, my own line, the Beaches, I've traced back to about 1670. And I've actually found my Beachy 10th cousins in Switzerland. You can do that if you know how and try hard. The odors have been traced back to 1240, I think. But beyond that, it gets pretty hazy and pretty murky. But let's get to this. In your Bible, yes, they were Christians, and you may have a map in the back of your Bible, and it'll show the area around the Mediterranean Sea. That's where Christianity started and developed. But we were living farther north. We were not living under Roman dominion. We were sort of half wild people. We were the Celtics. And if you wonder for proof that we're from the Celtic tribes, I see some red hair here this morning. The only people in the world that you possibly come from, if you have any red beard or red hair, is from the Celtics. Nowhere else. Now, here's a surprise. We were not always Christian. Let's say that if we had a blackboard up here, I'd get somebody up here to make some figures, but we'll just do without. And about the year 30, around there somewhere, was when Christ left and when the Christian church was begun. And for about the first 600 years, we were not Christians. We were heathen. We were not in that Bible land section that we read about in the Bible. We were farther north. And for about, like I say, for about 600 years, we were heathen. Now, how many generations is that? Maybe I'll ask you the question, how long is a generation? Anyone?
30 years.
30? Anyone else?
I heard it's over 33.
What? 33. Well, those are pretty close, both of them. And I can't say that I have the answer to that, but one time I took 50 families at random from the hospital book, just page through, and I took this family and this family and this family, and I checked where the wife had her middle child. That's about where you go by generation. It's 28 years. All right, if we would go, if I'm saying that we were heathen for 600 years, that's about 21 generations. We knew nothing about God. I think Harold Dean remembers on our tour a few years ago, we walked way up to the top of a mountain, and there was an old heathen temple. That's where our people used to go to worship. Knew nothing about God. Worship the sun and the moon and the big trees and whatever, and also high areas. So for 21 generations, we were heathen. And then finally, the Romans conquered us. And I must say this, too. You read actually about our people in the New Testament three times. If you see the word barbarian, which occurs three times, the reason the Greeks called us barbarians is because when they heard us talk, all they heard was ba-ba-ba. So they called us the ba-ba-barians. So those are our people. And then the Catholic, when the Romans overcame us, they brought with them Catholic priests. And we were very easily converted to Catholicism, to Christianity, but Catholicism. And then from the year about 618 to 1525, works out for 33 generations, we were Catholic. So your ancestors were 21 generations heathen, there were 33 generations Catholic. And then comes the Reformation in 1525. And without anyone deciding what they're going to be, the government decided, now you're no longer Catholic, you're now Reformed. And from 1525 to about 1679, we were Reformed. Now, of course, if you read a Mennonite history book, you'll say we had a beginning in 1525. Yes, the Anabaptists did, but not our people. We were still Reformed for about five and a half generations. And now, we'll get into this story a little. Around 1679, something was happening in Switzerland, and a new group emerged, and that's what this book talks about. So now about 12 generations, we're Amish. We're Amish for 12 generations, but twice as long we had been heathen, and three times as long we were Catholic, and half as long we were Reformed. So that is maybe sort of an eye-opener for us. I'd like to do something else. Can someone name a point that comes to your mind about 45 miles from this church? A city or a village, a few miles here or there, 45 miles, where would that take you? Where? Mifflinburg. That's about 45 miles. Okay, now I want to get another point across here. What do you suppose, if you were born in an Amish home, what do you suppose is the chance that you were born in an Amish home? One chance out of 160,000. Now, the reason I ask you about Mifflinburg, you've probably been to an Amish wedding where there were too many people for the amount of tables they had that set. The table settings were 18 inches apart, and when to eat, you had to eat like this. You didn't have any elbow room, 18 inches. If we would set a row of benches from here to Mifflinburg along the road, that would be room for 160,000 people. One of those was born Amish. Your chance was pretty small. Pretty, pretty small. All right? That's the second point I want to remember. The third point is that each congregation has a discipline package. You have yours, we have ours at Peniel, may be a little different. But I think we should honor that discipline package. It makes it pretty easy for the ministers if we lay members honor the discipline package. If we don't honor the discipline package, they'll have to constantly be harping on discipline and don't get the gospel preached, and then we blame them. You're not preaching the gospel, you're just preaching discipline. Well, let's look at this way, the discipline package. I would rather be a member of a church that restricts me, and I would say at Penile, yes, we have a few things that I would say we could change, but I'm not going to be the fellow that pushes that. I would rather be a member of a church that restricts me than to be a member of a church that tolerates behavior that I cannot conscientiously commune with. I'd much rather be restricted than have something that I can't commune with. And remember this, if there is disrespect, if there is disobedience in your church and you know about it and you commune with it, you're a partaker. Don't forget that. All right. Now we'll try and get into this book. You're not going to be able to see. I'm going to invite you to sit back somewhere where you can see if you care to. What this chart is, this book has 9 chapters. And this, since I don't have my projector and I don't have 50 overhead transparencies with you, we'll have to make do with this. And I don't have a laser pointer, so I borrowed a yardstick this morning. And so the 9 things you see here are the 9 title pages to the 9 chapters in the book. And I want to talk a little bit about this. One of the main things that this book brings out is that the story of the founding of the Amish is radically different than what we had been taught. You probably remember being taught that our founder was Jacob Ammon, and that he tore away from the Mennonite church in 1693, made a big commotion, and founded a new group called the Amish. Well, that's totally wrong. To begin with, our founder was not Jacob Ammon, and our beginning was not in 1693. We were already well-founded in 1693 with about 2 or 3 dozen ministers involved. We were an entirely new Anabaptist movement, that every one of us was a convert from the Reformed Church in the late 1600s. We don't go back to 1525. Yes, there were Anabaptists in Switzerland in 1525, but we were Reformed. And then comes a man not named Jacob Ammon, but Ulrich Miller, comes on the scene, and he preaches in the forests, in the living rooms, and in the barns. And he has a tremendous following. In 20-some years' time, this is hard to believe, and normally I take time to read the names, the family names of those people that came out of the state church into this new movement in 20 years' time, but we don't have time for that today. 20 family names. And the Yoders, for instance, we know that from Jost Yoder's family, Jost Yoder had 12 children, we know that 7 of his were converted to this new movement, but I count them as one. That's one family name. Tremendous movement, and that is part of the story of this book. We did not tear away from the Mennonites. There was a confrontation in 1693, but it was not a division. The division came the next year. In 1694, there's a specific date. But that is chapter 2. But that's the main big thing about this book. It helps us to have a better understanding about our past. Normally, if an Amish boy, the age of these fellows, would pick up some Mennonite history books and they'd read that dark chapter that said Amish division, you'd be ashamed that you're Amish. You don't need to be. You should be glad that you are. Now, we are a part of the Mennonite tree. We're a branch of the Mennonite tree. And usually, there's a tendency for us, we don't want to be known as Amish anymore. We're Mennonite now. Well, we are Mennonite. But what kind of Mennonite are you? Are you an Amish Mennonite? Or are you among those Mennonites today who tolerate divorce and remarriage, who invite homosexuals and lesbians and gays in the congregation, and the women come with no coverings, with cut hair, come in slacks? Those are Mennonites, some of them. Now, there are plain Mennonites, I know. But would you rather be an Amish Mennonite who does not tolerate divorce and remarriage? We do not have gays and homosexuals. And we do, and our women are covered, and their hair are not cut. And the men are bearded like we should be. So let's not forget, we don't need to be ashamed that we're Amish. We are. And so normally, because that's the main feature of the book, we would start in chapter 1, but I started in chapter 2 with that story. It's called, what is it called? A New Beginning. Chapter 1 is called Faith on Test. I did that because any important event like this founding of the Amish in the late 1600s, anything like this, there are events that lead up to this. It just didn't fall out of the sky one day and just happen. And some of the things that were developing, I explain in chapter 1. And I wish I had my projector here to show you more, but in the chapter 1 begins with the story of Hans Landes. Hans Landes was the last Swiss Brethren preacher executed in Switzerland. Literally executed, had his head chopped off. Good man, but they couldn't handle him. The government couldn't handle him, so they cut his head off. In the last drawing in the chapter 1, I show some dominoes set up. You know how children, they don't play dominoes as a game. They set them up in a row, and just far enough that one hits the other, and they topple over, and they topple over. That's the, I call that the domino effect. And because of this domino effect, beginning with Ulrich Miller, I explained that how Ulrich Miller had an effect on a, after he was beheaded, he had an effect on a man named Uli Wagemann, who took the ministry on. And when Uli Wagemann was gone, he had an effect on a man named Heinrich Frick. And Heinrich Frick had an effect on a young 15-year-old orphan in Switzerland in a little village named Meschwanden. And it was this 15-year-old orphan who 35 years later became the founder of the Amish. His name was Ulrich Miller. So that's first chapter. And now the second chapter is how that our group formed in Switzerland, beginning, I think, in 1673, by a man named Ulrich Miller. Now, I like to have documentation for something. We don't just say that there was a different founder without some documentation, and this book does have documentation. You can't see this from there, but here is something that I found in the archives in Bern, Switzerland. And it says, Der Wiedertäufer Ulrich Miller befindet sich in Thun im Gefängnis. The Anabaptist Ulrich Miller finds himself in Thun in prison. And on the next page, again, we read about the Wiedertäufer Ulrich Miller, and dated 1680. That's later. But here is a list of, and this I found in the archives in Bern, Switzerland. It's a list of 13 people from 1673 to 1683 when this new movement was being formed, 13 people that were fined half the value of their farm for letting this man preach on their premises. Now, I don't know how many of you are farmers, but if you were fined for half the value of your farm, could you reach in your pocket? Could you reach in your pocket and write out a check for half the value of your farm? Probably not. Some of these people, it took, some paid their fee in 2 years. I found one that it took 30 years to pay that fine until he again had a clear title to his land. But that's our founder, Ulrich Miller. Okay, now let's go. We'll just have to leave it by that. It's quite a story. And then we go into chapter 3. Chapter 3 says, oh, but for a home. The time came when we had to leave Switzerland. We were forced out. And I show a picture in this book of in the church in Steffensburg. Harold Dean was there. He saw this. On the wall, there's a Wandtafel, a plaque wider than I can reach and taller than a man. That church was built in the 1100s. In 1682, it needed to be remodeled. And the people from the Reformed Church that had the money to furnish the money to rebuild this church got their name and their coat of arms on this plaque. Among them is Joost Joder, the father of seven Joders who converted to this new group. But in one corner, there's Christian Gingrich, the father of all the Gingrichs you know. And 5 miles from there is another church that we had visited when Harold Dean was along. The next morning, we had devotions in this building. And that church was built in 1693 with money from confiscated Amish farms. But they didn't have enough money to build a bell tower and a clock tower. When they found out that in 1682, Christian Gingrich was helping furnish money to rebuild this Reformed church. 10 years later, it was discovered that he was a co-minister with Jacob Ammon. And they caught him, penned him up for the night, and were going to take him to prison and burn the next day. He broke out that night, took his family, and left with what they could carry on their backs. They sold his farm, they sold his cattle, his weaving equipment and everything he had, and they had enough money to build that tower. So if you ever go to Switzerland, you'll see the tower that was built with Christian Gingrich's money. But we have to move on here. But now if you have to leave the country, let's say you have to leave Pennsylvania, where are you going to go? You don't have much time, maybe 2 or 3 days. Where are you going to go? Well, they ended up mostly in France and in Germany. And that chapter is, where did we go? Where did we actually live? And on our tours, we were actually, I think, as close to 100 sites we know where our people actually live. And so that's that story. And the fourth chapter is now. Even those who had left Switzerland and were under less restrictions, still were taken advantage of. They were overtaxed, and finally Pennsylvania came up. They heard about this Pennsylvania across the ocean. And those who could would come. That's what I call the first wave of immigration of the 1700s. One Mennonite historian I remember said in his book that perhaps as many as 50 Amish families came in the 1700s, I found 200. And they're named. It's Nicholas Dolsfus, and it's Peter Beechey, and it's your ancestors. 200 of your Amish ancestors that came, and it tells you when they came, on what ship they came, where they landed in Philadelphia, of course, and where they first settled. Okay, chapter 5 is entitled On the Move Again, and it shows a family, I think a man and a wife going with a, she is riding a horse and he's walking along the side. And they're moving from Berks County, Pennsylvania, where we had first settled, to Somerset County. Different Mennonite historians have hassled with that question. Why all of at once did all these Amish leave Berks County and come to Somerset County? One said, well, the soil wasn't very good and the soil had depleted. What really happened, it was the Revolutionary War. And in eastern Pennsylvania, the rebels wanted our, not only our boys, but anyone up to 52 years of age. And because we didn't budge, there's a story in this chapter about 14 Amish men, your ancestors, who were in confinement in the Reading Jail with a death sentence on their head. On a certain day in November, they were supposed to be executed because they did not they refused to take military training. Well, they were not executed. It wasn't a real government, it was the rebels. They didn't want to kill our people, they wanted to scare us into subjection. But anyhow, that's part of the story. And then what happened there is, yes, the older people were landowners and they couldn't very well leave Berks County, but the young fellows that were just turning 18, they really wanted those, and they took off. I think in that chapter there's a record of 62 Amish boys, again, your ancestors, who left Berks County, crossed the Blue Mountains over into what is now Somerset County. It was not Somerset County then. It was Indian territory. And they settled there. Then after the war, their parents came. So that's pretty much chapter 5. Chapter 6 says, to the wilderness. And this is especially, I'm interested in this because I live in Holmes County. And this is the story of the settlement of Holmes County, beginning in 1809. 90% of the people that came to Holmes County in those first 30 years were from Somerset County. 5% were from Mifflin County. 5% were from directly overseas. All right, and that's that story. Now that is, all those six chapters are in book one. Now, I think in the seventh chapter, you see a picture of a young fella with a bag, and his sister is a little off to the side with her apron up here, and she's weeping. Her brother is leaving for America in the 1800s. I should have told you this also. The Amish settlements in Pennsylvania began around 1732, and immigrants, those 200 families, came until 1776 when war broke out, when the rebels declared war on the English king. Then there was absolutely no passenger shipping for about 25 years. Passenger immigration stopped completely. So we have a 1700s immigration, and then in about 1805 we had a new immigration started of Amish. And I was not going to write a chapter on that, because I knew only about two families that came, and that was the Swartz and Troopers and the Gingrichs. And I thought, well, it's not worth writing a chapter on two families. What I did find is that many, many, many more came in the 1800s. At least 3,600 people I have named that came in the 1800s. But many of them were young fellows just approaching their 18th birthday, because Napoleon was trying to do what Hitler was trying to do in my day, unify Europe, and he needed a large army. And then the other nations had to arm themselves against Napoleon, and they also wanted our 18-year-old boys. So the Amish, if they possibly could, they'd send their sons to America. And if they could only afford to send one, he would come and he would work and sent the money back, and so his next brother could come, and sometimes the entire family could come. And that young fellow that you see there with his bag and his sisters weeping, when they said goodbye, that was goodbye. No email, no mail, no telephones, absolutely no communication except mail, but that could take a year. So that was goodbye. So it was a sad occasion. Chapter 8, Reasons to Believe. I write about in the Reasons to Believe. Well, maybe I should read a little bit on that if I can find it quickly. It is the purpose of this chapter to follow through history the various ideas, events, and processes that have shaped the Amish faith and mentality, both in how it conforms to or differs with that of other Christians or non-Christians. As Amish, we do have a mentality, a special mentality. We differ even with some Mennonites who would allow things that we couldn't think of tolerating. And we differ greatly from the Catholics. We differ, let me say this. Yes, the Methodists are Christians. The Episcopalians are Christians. The Presbyterians are Christians. The Baptists are Christians. But the Anabaptists are the only ones that can say, in 300 years of history, we have not shed one drop of blood for the propagation of our religion. Baptists can't say that. They go, if there's war, they go and fight. Recently, this may surprise you. You know about the Mormons. A Mormon came to my home. He went with how many? Five cases of books. That's 22 volume sets. A Mormon. He wants to take it back to Utah for his Mormon friends. And he told me an interesting story that sort of relates to this. The Mormons have the Bible, but they have a special book called the Book of Mormon. And he said his father had a friend who was in the American army fighting against the Germans back in the 40s. And one day this American soldier came behind the lines of the German lines, and he saw a German soldier had dug himself a foxhole, and he had his gun there, but he was reading a book, a little book. And this American went up, crept up and shot him. And he saw as he shot him, he dropped the book. And then he looked, what was this book? It was the Book of Mormon. One Mormon had shot another Mormon. And I'm sure that many Christians have shot other Christians. Many Methodists have shot other Methodists. We do not need to say that. We have kept clear from that, and that is one of the geniuses of our Anabaptist movement. This chapter on Reasons to Believe starts with the first chapter in the first verse in the Bible about how God created, because I say this is a special mentality, and not everybody believes that. So already there's a big dividing point. And then we go through, from where did we develop our mentality? Well, I start with Noah. Noah was a preacher of righteousness. Not everybody, if you would go to the city of New York or maybe some other cities, there are lots of young fellows the age of these fellows, and they don't know that there is such a thing as right and wrong. They don't know. They've never been taught that. But Noah was a preacher of righteousness. He said there is right and there is wrong. It's not very specific what he believed, but we learned that from Moses. Moses gave us the Ten Commandments, and now we know this is right and this is wrong. And then we had the prophets. We learned a lot from them. But with all that revelation that came from God at specific times, the people were always hungry for something else. They were always looking for something better. What do you suppose that something better was? When did it come? It came when Jesus came. And especially at the Sermon on the Mount, that is a big divide between the Anabaptists and the Methodists and the Episcopalians. They will readily go to war. We can't, because Jesus said we must love our enemies. And we have never figured out how we could take a machine gun and mow down the enemy if we loved them. And some other things we could never figure out. If Jesus said, he who believeth and is baptized, we could never figure out why we should baptize babies, because they can't believe. You can't teach them no more than I can teach my dog, because they don't have their conception isn't developed. So there are things which just simple little things that we take in the Bible that makes a complete different mentality than many people whom we call Christians. The last chapter is entitled A Century of Division. I was afraid to write this chapter and did not really think I would until finally I did. In Holmes County, let me go back this way. The Amish had their beginnings in Switzerland around 1670, not 1693. We never had a split until in 1860 in Holmes County. Everybody, there was no such thing as Old Order Amish. You were just Amish. There wasn't an Old Order, you were just Amish. And then there were some people who wanted Sunday school and they wanted a church building and maybe a few other things. But automobiles were not involved, electricity was not involved, computers were not involved, there was no such thing. And so there was a division, that was the first division, 1860, and that held until 1912. And then we had several. In 1900, then, there were two groups. There was the Church Amish, which is like us. Today we call them the Mennonites. But they're not of the old Mennonite background. They are of Amish background. If there's Yoders and Millers and Beaches and Troyers, Swartz and Troopers, they were Amish at one time, not Mennonite. At 1900, we had two groups. When the new group formed, then the old group was called the Old Order. So we had the Old Order and the Church Amish. At the end of the century, we had 36 divisions. 36. We had learned that if I don't agree with you, I don't have to go to the same church as you. I can start a new church. And that's not a good thing. But that's what happened in Holmes County, and I tell the story in that last chapter. You have to be very careful you don't tramp too hard on people's toes. So I tried to get permission from each group. And what I did, I named the cause of this new movement, who was involved, and maybe a little bit how it turned out. I'll have to tell you one. Johnny Schrog was the son of an Old Order bishop. And he took a liking to a girl in the conservative church. But he was going to stay Amish, so she became Amish. But it lasted only for about a year, and then he decided to join her church. And he was a man with a gift. He was a very gifted speaker, and he soon became ordained. But then he also began reading some Pentecostal books, and he became sort of a Pentecostal preacher. And today you just go to church. There's no discipline package, let's just put it that way. So I called Johnny, because normally, you know, we have your church works with some other group that you're pretty much in the same, and you exchange pulpits and you can commune together. So I asked Johnny, is your church, Berlin Christian Fellowship, do you have Hindern Steige Verbindung mit Anrichtmene? Do you have a strong attachment to other churches in Holmes County? I wasn't quite sure. Then, oh, yes, he said. We have six groups that we play ball with every summer. So that's their fellowship. And I put it in the book just that way, because that's what he said. Now, let me say a little bit something about some conclusions I reached about the 36 divisions. What's going on here? I think one thing is, on the part of us lay members, lack of respect for the leadership. That's a strong point. we take it into our own hands, and so forth. And another thing I want to mention, you preachers, be very careful. You will not end up with an Anabaptist congregation if you preach Protestantism across the pulpit. I was once a member of a Beachy congregation where not all I heard, but frequently I would hear quoted, A.W. Tozer, A.W. Tozer, A.W. Tozer, A.W. Tozer. One day after the church, I got enough strength to tell the bishop, we are not Tozerites, we are Mennonites. And we are not Warrenites either. We don't follow the teachings of Rick Warren. Yes, they have good teaching, but they're not non-resistant. Instead, and I told this man, instead of quoting A.W. Tozer, quote Menno Simons. All the good things that A.W. Tozer says, Menno Simons also says. Quote Menno Simons and quote the Martyr's Mirror, and we're Mennonites. All right, that's all. Oh, yes, one more thing. We don't sell books on Sunday, but we do have, we were to another meeting and we have quite a number of books along. If you're interested in a two-volume set, you won't pay it today. If you just tell us and you can take it along home, and next week you can send us the money. And so thank you for your attention. I didn't even use my yardstick much, Harold Dean.